It's Friday, September 27th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I wanted to talk about, since there's so much miserableism in the world, and I am embarking on an against miserableism world tour pretty soon. But here's a thing, here's a development that makes me happy. And it's not something that anyone tinkered with in a lab. It's not something that society got together and decided on. It's not certainly not something that members of an Ivy League institution said, oh, this would work. It's not even something that people said, let us now change a social norm. All it is an expression that has changed. And I think pretty naturally, pretty organically, it's changed for the better. And the expression is, I appreciate you. You know, we used to say, hey, appreciate it, or I'd appreciate it if you would knock it off. But now, instead of the it, or the even the dashed off, not even mention it, appreciate it, which is like, I love you. It's not a real expression of love or really anything. It's sort of obligatory. Now, people say, they will say, I appreciate you. And I don't know how sincere they are. I think that maybe after you've heard it a couple hundred times, you just think that's the way to say it. It becomes natural. It becomes insincere. But it seems a little more sincere than appreciate it. It seems like an advance forward in our de rigueur expressions. Because we've had several advances backwards. I've talked about this, standing online, and someone will say, following customer, can I help the following customer? That's not right. It's, can I help the next customer? We're only following in relation to people who went before us. Anyway, that expression will probably die as standing in line at retail establishments themselves die. But I like appreciate you. It seems much more directed at me, the individual. I mean, it's not like I say it. I like receiving it. But I do wonder if it is meant or sincere. And I think back to the very first time I ever heard the phrase, know what I'm saying? I remember exactly where I was. I was at a Nobody Beats the Wiz in the Green Acres Mall, and I had returned from Korea, and I was trying to get electronics, maybe a pager. This is before the whole Hezbollah thing. And I went in, and oh no, I think actually it was, I was getting maybe a single CD player, the Walkman version of CD. Which was great because you could jog and it would only skip every single time. So I went in and the salesperson there, although back then we called them the salesman there, who was the sales guy, was constantly saying to me as I was explaining what I wanted, you know, maybe it could skip only like every third step. He was saying, yes, well, here are our CD players. You know what I'm saying? And this over here is a really good model. You know what I'm saying? And I had never heard this expression before. Maybe it's because I was in Korea for an extended length of time and the rhetorical innovations of my homeland had bypassed me, or I had just not noticed that, know what I'm saying, had swept the universe or the American side of the universe. And I remember interacting with him as if he were sincerely and earnestly after and asking for the question, do you comprehend what I just said? So the conversation went like this. I'm looking for a CD player. Oh yeah, what do you want? Like a standalone or a Walkman? Oh, I want a Walkman. Do you have good models? Yeah, Sony makes a good model. Know what I'm saying? Oh yes, I know what you're saying. Sony is one of the leaders in personal electronics. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now they have a high end and a low end. You know what I'm saying? Yes. The different levels of electronics are often differentiated by price point and functionality. And it went on like this. I had no idea if he just thought I was a little spectrum-y, if I was like the guy in the Bud Light commercial, the guy with the big hat from Texarkana, who when the New Yorkers were like, how you doing? He was like, I am doing well. I don't know if he thought I was like Chauncey Gardner from Being There.
I like to watch.
But I was something. Know what I'm saying? I think you do know what I'm saying. And for knowing that, guess what? I appreciate you. On the show today, I shall bring you a full show interview with Wright Thompson. He's one of my absolute favorite writers, one of the great sport writers, sports or sport, if you're British, sport writers of the age. He plies his trade on ESPN, and he is the kind of guy, well, I think we could say of Wright Thompson, if he did not exist, we'd have to invent him. He is a southerner. He is genteel. He sees his own world and our world in fascinating and insightful ways and spins a phrase around it. His new book is about the most horrible story that we know that comes from where he comes from, the Mississippi Delta. It is about the exact place where Emmett Till was murdered, which was before Wright and a few others started looking into it, the subject of what is generally called, and I think this is a word that's overused, erasure. But in this case, it is an apt word, though the barn still stands as an actual structure. And now, as a book by Wright Thompson, The Barn, The Secret History of a Murder in Mississippi. Wright Thompson up next. Let's think about what we know about the murder of Emmett Till. We know about the open casket, a mother's bravery, the facts of the case, August 1955, 2:30 a.m., two men, at least two men, white men, Roy Bryant, J.W. Milam, banging on a door. We're looking for the boy that did the talking. This was Emmett Till's supposed crime, whistling at a white woman. He was murdered. He was brutalized. He was thrown in the Tallahatchie River, 14 years old. We often skip past the fact that he was about a month and a week just past his 13th birthday. Just turned 14.
Yeah, just turned 14. He liked comic books, Mike. He liked comic books.
That voice you're hearing is Wright Thompson, one of our great writers in the field of sports and history and Mississippi. And he's gotten obsessed with and written about The Barn, The Secret History of a Murder in Mississippi. Because when I was talking in the beginning about all the things we know, what we don't know, unlike so many other sites of great tragedy in American history, well, where did it actually happen? He was found, Emmett Till was found in the river, but here in New York City, we have memorials around the 9/11 site. You go to Stonewall, which stopped being Stonewall for many years and then was reestablished as Stonewall because we thought it was important to memorialize prejudice and oppression of gay people. And yet, in Wright's native Mississippi, there is a collective forgetting of what happened to Emmett Till, where it happened until now. Wright Thompson, welcome back to The Gist.
Man, it's a pleasure to be back. One of the things that struck me when I first started was that this is a very famous murder. And there, countless books and, there was a TV show and a movie last year alone. And the stunning total of what we don't know really blew me away and spoke to the degree to which the erasure of this crime has been ongoing and intentional. And I mean, it's not like I'm, wizard reporter, like, the next person who comes along and does this is probably going to find new stuff too. I mean, there've been so many lies, so many acts of intentional erasure around this murder that, I found that the murder weapon was in a safety deposit box in a bank in Greenwood, Mississippi. I found that all of the file folders at the courthouse didn't have anything in them. I found that the famous Look magazine that has the confession at the Ole Miss and Delta State in the Delta libraries, the magazine is in the library, but the confession is torn out. Over and over, you see that this was a crime that people tried to erase. And the reason, of course, is that in the murder of a child and what happened in this barn, which has been written out of the story for, almost 70 years, you find a mirror that a lot of Americans, not just Mississippians, and we'll get to that, but Americans don't like to look at.
So this barn physically stands just about the geographic center of the Mississippi Delta. Describe it. Describe what it was known as before people started realizing what it meant.
So the Mississippi Delta is some of the most fertile ground in the world. It was the last great American cotton boom, sort of like 1890 to 1920. And it was sort of the center of the sharecropper South. The barn sits, land is divided into 36 square mile blocks called townships. And this was established in the Land Ordinance Act of 1785, Thomas Jefferson. And each of those townships is divided into 36 sections of land. When you hear people talk about like 40 acres and a mule, mm-hmm. 40 acres is a quarter of a quarter section. And so the barn is Township 22 North, Range 4 West, measured from the Choctaw Meridian. And even in the laying down of the grid, every political fight we've had in America ever since was like set in motion. You had Thomas Jefferson fighting with Alexander Hamilton over what was the most land someone be allowed to buy and what was the cap on the purchase price, because Jefferson wanted it to go to poor subsistence farmers and Alexander Hamilton wanted it to be owned by big, heavily capitalized investors, because that's how you grow an economy. And so, you know, we've been having that fight with different words and different proxies essentially ever since. And so the barn sits at the center of the Mississippi Delta, Township 22 North, Range 4 West. And what becomes remarkable is all of the other things that happened in this same 36 square mile box that start to make you realize that, that, you know, everything is everything, you know, where it's Nathan Bedford Forrest family had a farm and his brother actually built the road the barn is on. Nathan Bedford Forrest was the Confederate general, founder of the Ku Klux, first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. Dockery Farms is within eyeshot, and it is where Sunhouse, Charlie Patton, Robert Johnson, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Pop Staples of the Staple Singers and Mavis Staples. I mean, it is the birthplace in many, many ways of all of American music. You've got one of the original architects of all the Jim Crow laws had land there. I mean, over and over and over, the intersections of history in this one square of land make this square and this barn and this murder, without much of a stretch, a proxy for, I mean, frankly, all of American history.
Who owns the barn in 1955? Who has access to the barn?
So the barn in 1955 is being purchased by Leslie Milam, who is the brother of J.W. Milam and the half-brother of Roy Bryant. They had the same mother. They had different fathers. They're so inbred that they had different fathers, but they had the same great-grandfather.
Ah.
So, like, you know, they grew up up in the sticks in the hills, and, you know, it's very Appalachian feeling. And he owned the barn. He was buying it from the Sturtevant family, who are big, still are big farmers in Mississippi. And, you know, they took it, they took Emmett there because they didn't know anyone else who, you know, it was probably not easy for them. They took him a long way. They went out of their way to go there. And it seems to me that they probably didn't have anywhere else to take him. I mean, you know, there wasn't much of a plan, it didn't seem like. And they were also pretty drunk.
So to orient everyone, J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant, they are the only two, they're half-brothers, they're the only two who stand trial.
That's right.
They are acquitted, as was baked into the cake in the judicial system at the time, despite what could be the first instance of black man standing up in court accusing white people of murder and himself not being murdered. But there are others. There are how many others who are directly involved in the Till murder?
So just as an example of sort of how so much of this remains unknown, two people were tried and acquitted. The barn was written out of their confession and the popular history specifically to protect Leslie Milam from prosecution. The only reason we know Leslie Milam was involved in the murder is he confessed to his priest on his deathbed. And the priest told me, and the priest told a guy named Devery Anderson. But like so there were J.W., there was Roy, there was Leslie, there were two of J.W.'s farmhands, two black men who were with him, who were forced to help. And then there were probably their brother-in-law, Melvin Campbell, who's married to their sister, Mary Louise, and possibly three other people. So 8 to 10, The filmmaker, Keith Beauchamp, who's made a great documentary about this, who's just, you know, Keith has pushed this ball forward a lot and is really somebody I admire tremendously. He thinks there was many as 14. I can't get there. I can get to eight, mm-hmm. but, you know, nobody knows. And to me, the lack of knowledge is a big part of the story. Because we're just completely covered up in erasure.
Yeah. And with even 8 or 14, just that large number, black men forced into service. Think about the pebble and thrown into the river and all the waves that it creates. It would seem that decades later, so many people would have knowledge of this. And so many people would not be able to contain the knowledge of it. And there is an actual gigantic looming sight of this murder that everyone looked at and many of them knew what it meant. And no one talked. What does that speak to?
So the only word that can describe it, and I mean, I use this word intentionally, is omerta. And the guy who owns the barn now is a dentist. His name is Jeff. Jeff did, and I believe him, did not know the history of the barn when he bought it. And immediately after he purchased it, his father told him, which means his dad knew the whole time and never, ever told him. I mean, this omerta between fathers and sons, I mean, maybe even especially between fathers and sons and mothers and sons and daughters, this was something that was so unspoken that during the pandemic, when I ended up, it's a long story that involves the Los Angeles Lakers player Avery Bradley, but I ended up making calls around about the Till case. And one of the people I talked to was this activist named Patrick Weems, who said, "Hey, have you ever been to the barn?" And I said, "What barn?" And it occurred to me that if you fundamentally don't know the history of the place that you think you know best in the world, maybe it's time to start learning. I mean, this was an obsession before it was attached to an assignment.
Because you, I mean, if we haven't, if they can't tell by your molasses drawl, you're from how far from there?
So my family farm is 23 miles from the barn.
Yeah.
And my mother grew up closer. She probably grew up 14 miles from the barn, 16 miles. I'm trying to do math.
Yeah. And did she even know of its existence?
No, I told her.
Yeah. What did she say? What is your family, the older generation of your family, say?
You know, I grew up in a really politically active family. You know, my dad was a civil rights lawyer and you know, political guy. We had a cross burned in our front yard in 1982, which is, you know, and like, I didn't know about this. And one of the things, my mom is really like politically active on Facebook. And mm-hmm. I'm always telling her, like, what are you doing? Like, who gives a shit? It's the fucking internet. You know what I mean? Like, who cares? Like, so you went and so what? And like, you know, she lives alone. I'm just worried about some of these crazy people, you know?
Yeah.
And she said that she realized that the silence when she was born in 1947, which means she would have been 8 years old when this happened. She was alive during the Freedom Summer, where there was a big march in her little hometown of 1,000 people. And she's like, I didn't know anything. And it was all, we just didn't speak of it. And she said, and I always promised myself that I would never be silent again. And so she said, that's why I engage all these lunatics on the internet. And so, I mean, there's a real sense of, if we just don't talk about it, then maybe it didn't happen.
So, okay. So then explain to me, let's analyze Faulkner as we must when talking with a Mississippi writer. Is it the case that the past isn't dead? It's not even past? It seems like in this case, there was every effort to make sure the past was dead, buried, never spoken of, and the word you've used a few times, erased.
Well, and I would say that it was that effort that kept the past alive unintentionally. Like in the context Faulkner means that is, I think, that the past isn't dead because we haven't buried it, because we haven't had a funeral for it. We haven't grieved and collectively moved on. And the only way for the past to truly be the past is for everybody to agree on the same set of facts and say, this is what happened. And for amends to be made, I don't mean even financial. I mean like spiritual amends, like let one human being look another human being in the eye and say, I'm sorry. And so the past isn't dead because we haven't even begun to sort of say, this is who we are and this is what happened here. And what is the postage stamp of common ground that we can build together to stand on and walk into the future? I mean, like Mississippi only really ended its formal caste system in 1970 when the schools integrated. It's not that long ago. And we've just wasted the last 54 years because we haven't actually started the work yet.
And as just one example of the concerted collective erasure, there is and was until very recently an institution called Strider Academy. And Strider is the sheriff who ensured that Emmett Till's killers would go free. And the academy is not just named for him. It was the school that he founded, right?
It's across a little highway. I think it's across Henry Strider Highway from Henry Strider's house, to give you an idea.
And this was one of these private schools established to rebut integration, right?
So the Mississippi Delta has an entire network of what are called segregation academies. So in many ways, the school systems remained segregated. Many still are. I was sitting in a restaurant with the owner of the barn one night, and a guy comes over to the table and recognizes him. I don't know him. And they start talking and he sits down and it is Henry Strider's grandson. And I just was floored. And it was interesting because he talked about how much, like he's really thought about this. You know, I mean, this guy sells farm seeds and chemicals. I mean, this isn't like, you know what I mean? Like he's like a good old boy, but he's thought a lot about what this means. And he just said, you know, it makes him try to figure out where hate comes from. Because he said, you know, I read what he said and what he did, and I'm just appalled. And yet I knew the guy as like a sweet old man. And he's like, and just trying to reconcile those two things. And, you know, it makes you realize that the people of the South are much more nuanced than our idiot politicians. And that people are trying to deal in some ways in this in three dimensions. And then there's this, I don't understand this whole urge to try to erase this history, to ban the teaching of it. You know, I'll be curious to see how this book lands in Mississippi. And, you know, it is incredibly counterproductive to try to delay learning the truth, because that's all these bans are, delays.
I bring up Strider Academy to make a point that's relates and fits in with what you were just talking about, and I get it from the book, which is if there is a thought this horrible crime was committed for many years, there was a cover-up, eventually here we are decades and decades later, there is some sort of acknowledgement of this horrible misdeed. We say we've grown, progress has happened. This is how human beings work. You might think that this happened. You might think that this is the natural course and progression of things. But of course, there's still the barn there that Wright is writing about, and no one's talking about that. And you go to the general area and you ask the people what they know and you talk to them. And many of them are graduates. These are Strider students. And they would never have been able to ever learn about what happened right there in their backyard. Dude. At the namesake of the place in charge of their education. It's pretty much as if, I don't know, Bernhard Rust, who was like the Nazi minister of education, if there were Rust academies to this day in and around Berlin defining history and facts. This is what it's like in that part of Mississippi.
The history book that I was taught from, the Mississippi history book that I was taught from in high school, did not mention Emmett Till or the Civil Rights Movement at all. The history book that they have now has 117 words on him, in which the entire murder is framed for how badly it made Mississippi's white citizens look. That's being taught right now today.
And we'll be back in a minute with more with Wright Thompson.
Early this morning, when you knocked up on my door, early this morning, ooh, when you knocked up on my door, and I said, "Hello, Satan, I believe it's time to go."
We're back with Wright Thompson, author of The Barn, The Secret History of a Murder in Mississippi. We, everyone, didn't know simple facts of where Emmett Till was actually murdered. The point being that the erasure and the omerta worked. It worked. It emanated out from Mississippi, and we could point to the Strider Academy and say we'd never teach our students like that, but still it worked.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that, like, what you start to uncover when you start pulling back the onion is that, you know, the money, the store where he whistled was in Money, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. The money planning company was owned by Charles Merrill, like Merrill Lynch. The Mississippi existed from 1800 to 1933, essentially as a colony of London, Manchester, Liverpool, and New York and Wall Street. And, you know, the whole point was to turn profit margins for faraway places. I mean, these were investments. You know, one of the reasons the largest plantation in the Mississippi Delta at the time of Emmett Till's death was owned by the Manchester Fine Doublers and Spinners Association, which was the largest manufacturing conglomerate in the world, which still exists. They make lingerie for Victoria's Secret and Marks and Spencer. The plantation still exists. It was owned by Monsanto, and it's now owned by Bayer, whose parent company ran Nazi camps and made Zyklon B. Like, all of this is a web, and it is, you know, global. Like, Mississippi was always a colony of all of these other places. And so you start following the money, which is an interesting thing I did, and you see that people in fancy boardrooms didn't particularly care what the violence was as long as they got their 10%. You start reading slave narratives, narratives of enslaved people, and one of the things that's like so shocking is that they reported the Liverpool price of cotton had direct impact on the violence. Because if the price got too low, the violence went up. But if the price got too high, the violence went up because there was more money to be made. You know, my mother growing up, her father subscribed to the Manchester Guardian newspaper because they were cotton farmers and you needed to know what was going on in Manchester if you were going to understand your business. And so the degree to which all of this
set. So they would ship it? They'd get it 2 weeks late, airmail?
It would get mailed. I think they'd get it 4 or 5 days late.
Huh.
But like the degree to which there's an interconnected web of commerce. If you have a 401k right now, you own some tiny piece of the plantation where Emmett Till was killed because it's owned by a publicly traded company and all of their largest Vanguard, BlackRock, Fidelity. If you have a 401k, you own a piece of the plantation where Emmett Till was murdered. I mean, the interconnected web of the finance of all of this is one of the many concentric circles of blame that starts raiding. You talk about the pebble. I mean, that's exactly right. That's the perfect metaphor. And so, you know, there just are like ever expanding concentric circles of blame.
What's your suggested solution to that? Divestment? It seems impossible.
It's impossible. Yeah. I mean, look, at the risk of sort of sticking my head in the lion's mouth, there is no solution. The solution is to everybody to go back and live in caves and to start this whole thing over and see if we somehow evolve differently, which of course we won't. And like, you can't undo it.
Right. The solution, though, is at least to know what is true.
That's right. To have the knowledge is the solution. Because, like, you can't unwind the entire global economy, and nobody wants to, because, like, you know, I can't grow all my own food. You know, like, I can't, like, I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, it's best not to have lifespans of an average of 34 years.
No, yeah. Dude, if this turned into a Cormac McCarthy novel, I would not last the first month. And so, you know, some dudes I went to high school with would. That's every time somebody talks about a civil war, I'm like, look, man, you don't want to fight the dudes I went to high school with. Like, do you know how to fix a tank? Because like, yeah. So the solution is, at least the first solution is knowledge. Because you can't divest of, the Italian government owns a ton of land in the Mississippi Delta. Mm. The Bill Gates is the third largest landowner in the state of Mississippi. I mean, and that's not new. That's always been the case, is that all of the global financial markets have always flowed through this place. I don't know why it is that the more land is worth, the less human life is worth, but that seems to be true over and over.
I just want to end by asking you a couple questions, maybe a few questions about writing and reporting. So reporters play a very important role in the trial, the unsuccessful trial of Till's murderers, and just getting the truth out in a way that, I don't know, probably strikes against some of the conceits of journalism today. Could you just tell me about what reporters did at the time?
I mean, they were actively involved in finding the witnesses that allowed the truth to come out. I mean, you had a group of black reporters, I think led by Simeon Booker, who were out trying to find the witnesses with the sheriff of LaFleur County. And the sheriff of LaFleur County, by the way, a guy named George Smith, is kind of a hero in this, because he was trying to do his job as all of the other law enforcement were trying to get these guys acquitted. But the reporters, I mean, some of these news stories read very modern, the writing and the reporting, and it was really dangerous. Like, a lot of reporters, the black reporters were having to stay at an armed compound in an all black town, about 10 or 15 miles away. This was an unbelievably dangerous thing to do. These were war correspondents, is the only way to really describe it. And they did. It's truly incredible, the bravery of the reporting, because, by the way, without that, there are no books. Mm-hmm. I mean, the historical record, the degree to which everybody who ever writes a single word about Emmett Till stands on Simeon Booker's shoulders is unbelievable. And like, there are a ton of these guys. And I mean, I'm just like, the reporting is incredible. And, you know, this wasn't like talking head bullshit. I mean, they were down there like gathering information under duress, and human life wasn't worth much there then. It was very clear that it was open season, and this was really dangerous. And so, you know, these guys were real heroes. And a lot of them would go on to cover the rest of the movement. You know, one of the guys who was covering the trial was the last person to ever interview Medgar Evers. And like, on and on and on and on, you see these people just at the intersection of history over and over and over again. And this was incredibly dangerous work. And, you know, there are a lot of heroes in this story. I mean, it's interesting because there's so many villains. But, you know, those reporters, Gloria Dickerson and Wheeler Parker, who are currently working in Chicago and Mississippi to try to protect the memory and the truth. And like, there are a lot of people, you know what? You want to think that like the divide is between good and evil, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm a good person. I'm a bad person. Like, people say all the time, I'm a good person. And like, I don't really think that has anything to do with anything. I think they're brave people and I think they're cowards. And I mean, there are a few good people and a few bad people. You know, the Milo and Bryant were definitely evil, you know, yeah. But like, most of the breakdown is not good or bad. most of it is brave or heroic. And I also learned you don't have any idea how you're going to react until faced with it. Like seeing the people who everything about their backstory indicated they would have reacted bravely, but didn't. And seeing people who had never done a single thing in their lives to suggest they would stand up to such an enormous, powerful machine and shake their fist at it. I mean, you just have no idea how you're going to react until called upon to react. And so it's almost sort of like, it's just performative and silly, frankly, to sort of talk about how you would behave. Because it's like, one of the things from reporting this book is like, you just can't tell.
Yeah. Last question I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Mississippi is usually ranked 49th or 50th by most education measures, yep, including literacy. What, and West Virginia's the other one who's either 49th or 50th. The list of West Virginia authors is not that impressive. The list of Mississippi authors will blow you away. From you to Faulkner to Eudora Welty, take John Grisham, Richard Wright. What accounts for this?
I think that we are a people trying to make sense of what happened here. I think this book is my attempt to understand where I'm from. I think it is a user's manual for my two children. I think that Kiese Layman, Natasha Trethewey, Jesmyn Ward, I think everybody's trying to make sense of what happened here. I wish you could drive through the Mississippi Delta, because the stuff that's abandoned, it looks like a bomb went off.
Yeah, you say, you know, you've been to Bosnia and Ukraine and war zones, and that's without that context, you couldn't understand it.
No, and like, I think it is very clear that there was some sort of failed experiment here. And, you know, this is a place where the commodity chain has moved on. Imagine going to the Middle East once there's no such thing as oil. You know, and like imagine going into Texas when oil doesn't exist.
Right.
Like, I think that, like, people are trying to sort out what happened here.
The name of the book is The Barn, The Secret History of a Murder in Mississippi. Wright Thompson wrote it and joined me. Wright, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Mike.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson is the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is the COO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oomperoo, gee-peroo, doo-peroo, and thanks for listening.